morning, I guess.
The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome back from a sunny, beautiful weekend. We'll pretend like it's not sunny and beautiful outside until we're done with the meeting. We're going to take the agenda today a little bit out of order. We are going to start with two work sessions. We're going to do those quickly. These are simply for the purpose of moving them on to other committees. So the first is House Bill 2674. I'd like to open a work session. Representative Dimbro, could you offer a motion without recommendation?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to. I'd like to move that House Bill 2674 be passed on to the Joint Ways and Means Committee without recommendation.
Thank you. So Representative Dimbro moves that House Bill 2674 be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2674 and open a work session on House Bill 3121. Representative Dimbro, same thing.
Yes, Madam Chair, and a similar motion. I move that House Bill 3121 be referred to the House Transportation Committee without recommendation, please.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dimbro moves House Bill 3121 be moved to the House Transportation Committee without recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Clarification, Chair.
Yes, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Is that the Policy Committee, not the Ways and Means Committee?
That is the Policy Committee, Transportation for the Keep Kids Safe registration plates.
Thank you.
They do all the plates.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3121. And we carried over a hearing. We ran out of time at the end of last Friday for House Bill 3205. We do have a very, very full agenda today, so we're going to devote no more than 10 minutes to this item. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3205. Do we have the testimony list? Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I'm going to invite up Vicki Chamberlain. Thank you, Vicki. And as I mentioned before, we're going to keep the total hearing to about 10 minutes, and there's four more folks after you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. My understanding that you received our written testimony last week, and I've been directed by the commission to ask you not to pass this bill this session. And without getting into a lot of details, we think there are a lot of issues that need to be worked out on scope. And right now, if an employer wants to hire a social worker, they can do that under a limited student services license. It's not as open as a school counseling and a school psychologist. I think there's time, more time, for the commission to talk about this issue. They've only had it up for two meetings, and it's been one of those evolving issues that we learn more information. There's a lot of concern about how the license gets created, because when we create a license, it often has the opposite effect of people believing it has to be required, and therefore it creates a shortage. So there's so many big issues around this, creating a big license like this, that we'd just like more time to work it out.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Chamberlain? Thank you very much. So next I would call up Christine Nelson, Monica Parmley, Karen Dittmar, and Ellen Baltus, please.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm here today to support HB 3205, a bill that would enable school...
And for the record, can you state your name? Thank you.
Christine Nelson. You need my address and all that stuff.
No, just your name is good.
Christine Nelson, Portland State University. The bill, as you know, would enable school districts statewide to employ master's level social workers as part of their student support efforts. As the dean of the School of Social Work, I'm very familiar with the curricular issues and the workforce issues, and I believe that a licensure through TSPC would help contribute to solving many of the problems that our school districts face in terms of retention and completion. You've heard from others and seen the letters submitted from several different school districts that there's a critical need for social work services. Already 32 states recognize this need and provide a licensing procedure. And out of the 35,000 school social workers in the United States, only 78 of them worked in Oregon schools in 2006. So we are critically undersourced in this area. I want to point out that the bill does not require school districts to employ social workers. It simply gives districts and principals the flexibility to hire the best person for the job to meet local needs. Right now, there's a great deal of confusion about whether schools can hire social workers. Many social workers have experienced being told that they cannot be hired because they're not licensed by TSPC, and I believe that this legislation would clarify the situation rather than add more confusion. In order for that social workers be completely prepared to work in educational settings, the School of Social Work has consulted national social work standards, school social work standards, and worked with the Graduate School of Education to develop a curriculum that could be employed as soon as next fall. We already have a course, a comprehensive course in school social work, and many of the research theory and practice courses cover required content. In addition, we already have over 60 internships in school settings that could be expanded to include instructional experience. We're also prepared to work collaboratively with TSPC, NASW, and PSU's Graduate School of Education and School of Extended Studies to offer appropriate continuing education for school social workers. In summary, we believe that the current licensure, licensed clinical social work, LCSW, covers only a part of what social workers need to know to work effectively in school settings, and that we believe licensure through TSPC would assure that they're thoroughly prepared to work in these positions. Thanks for your listening to me.
Thank you very much. And I forgot to hit go on our new egg timer here, so I'm going to do that this time. I have it set for 2 minutes.
Hello again. My name is Monica Parmley. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in Portland. And I submitted a written testimony as well as a written testimony from a principal in Portland Public Schools stating that when she received a grant 2 years ago to hire a school counselor, that grant was very clear that the person who applied for the job had to have TSPC licensure. I had been involved in that school for 6 years doing school social work through various nonprofits, and while she wanted to hire me, she was not able to because I could not be licensed by TSPC. My position now with Portland Public Schools was actually created by a school board member for Portland Public who recognized that there were not as many social workers in schools as there needed to be, so I have 5 interns who are providing social work services at 5 high schools in the area. Because the school counselors who are there don't have the capacity to meet social service needs on top of scheduling and forecasting needs. So I think that there's a very clear reality that this need is out there, and I just ask that you would consider passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Hi, I'm Ellen Baltus, and I was here for a couple minutes last Friday, and I just wanted to speak again about why the certification process is necessary. I don't think the bill would have been written if we felt like there was already an ease in hiring social workers, and I think in the over 15 years that I've worked in the school districts in Portland Public Schools and now in North Clackamas, I've seen a reduction in the opportunities for social workers in the school despite the need increasing. And I think part of that is because of the lack of TSPC licensure. I think educators just understand that process. Districts understand that process. Obviously, grants that are granted to different districts understand that. And so having this certification legitimizes social workers in the school. Recently, we were given some federal stimulus dollars to our district, and our special ed administrator wanted to hire social workers and went to one of our social workers and said, how can we hire, we want to hire two more social workers, but they need to be licensed, and this person isn't licensed by TSPC, so how do we do that? So there is a confusion that exists out there amongst districts. This would standardize that process, I believe.
Thank you very much. Please.
I think I'm going to pay off. All right. I had a chance to testify last week, and I think they have covered the main points that need to be covered.
Thank you all very much.
Could I ask one quick question?
Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, and because you had mentioned about other states. The concern that I have goes to the fact that we have accreditation standards that most of our schools try to meet, Northwest accreditation and so on. And in there, they say you need to have a ratio of counselors to students of a certain number. Would social workers meet the criteria, even if they were certified, of meeting the counselor certification? Or would it just be counselors? Because I don't see how it would help you if it didn't.
Can I talk to that a minute?
Can you introduce yourself?
Karen Dittmar.
Thank you.
And I was a social worker in schools for 38 years, both in Michigan, New York, Portland Public Schools, and then I ended up in the Evergreen School District. In the state of Washington, you can have either an MSW or a school counseling degree and be qualified to hire in any position in the school system. And that's the model that we would like to see for Oregon.
And presently, we do have that on the revised statute, the Child Development Specialist, which is what I am. I'm an elementary school counselor position in MSW without a licensed school counseling. And so I would meet that criteria as far as the ratio. So that presently does exist, and we'd like to remain that to be the case.
Great. Thank you all very, very much. And are there any final questions for this panel? All right. Thank you. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3205. We also carried over from Friday a public hearing on House Bill 3050. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3050. There's no one signed up. Is there anyone here today that came back to testify on House Bill 3050 from last week? Nope. All right. Seeing that, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3050. And I'm now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3093. Kevin, do you want to give us a brief overview? And Representative Edwards, do you want to come on up, please? Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 3093, requires the Joint Board of Education to develop a plan for accrediting community colleges and state institutions of higher education for purposes of offering an applied baccalaureate degree. There are four components of that degree that would be included. It also defines an applied baccalaureate degree. Further, the board's plan, that being the Joint Board of Education's plan, must include a series of criteria that need to be met. This bill requires also the board to submit a report with proposed legislation to the Interim Committee on Higher Education prior to November 1st, 2010, and it does declare an emergency.
Thank you very much. Representative Edwards, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm, for the record, I'm State Representative David Edwards. I represent House District 30, which encompasses Greater Hillsborough, North Plains, and Roy and Verbort in Washington County. Pleased to bring this bill before you. The main purpose of this bill is to develop four types of what's called an applied baccalaureate degree. Oregon is one of only 11 states in the country that does not currently offer one or more applied baccalaureate options. These options, in my opinion, have the potential to encourage more Oregonians to pursue lifelong education, to help citizens maximize their earning potential, and to accelerate the state's attainment of its 40-40-20 goal for educational achievement. Higher education, I believe, has a responsibility to provide programs and degree pathways that ensure adult learners have post-secondary opportunities. And in our global economy in the 21st century, our community's success will be determined by the training of our workforce. By providing flexible options in education, allowing for career advancement and job progression, we're setting up our citizens for long-term success. To be more explicit, the bill will charge the joint boards of higher ed with developing a plan for authorizing community college and Oregon University System schools for the purpose of offering four types of applied baccalaureate degrees. I will hand out some explanatory material to the committee assistant momentarily, and you'll be able to see these types of degrees for yourself. In brief, they include the following four options. One is a career ladder type applied baccalaureate. In this option, the student would be able to take a substantial number of upper-level courses in the technical major of the applied associate's degree in order to receive a four-year degree. In the inverse or upside-down version, the degree would allow a student to basically get a terminal associate's degree and then turn around and get general ed credits to add up to a four-year degree, treating the original terminal degree as credits towards the student's major. In the third option, which is called the management ladder degree, basically the degree is designed to provide the recipient with applied management skills sufficient to prepare for a managerial position in addition to school. And then the last version, it's called the work experience option, and that degree would consist of a combination of general education and or technical coursework along with the direct supervised work experience in a relevant field. As I stated, Oregon is one of only 11 states without an applied baccalaureate program. And there are, I should note, a couple of potential changes to the bill in talking with stakeholders. We're in the process of coming up with very minor amendments. They consist of changes in two categories. The first would to substitute the word accrediting, which is mentioned in two areas, with a suitable substitute. Originally we tried certifying and that didn't prove acceptable, so now we're looking at perhaps authorizing or changing the language somewhat slightly to allow for a greater flexibility. And there'll be somewhat some adjustments to some of the directive verbs, shall and must, in various areas to may, to give additional flexibility to the joint boards and giving them additional discretion in terms of the types of options that are ultimately offered by our community colleges and institutions of higher learning. And with that, I am happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Edwards? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edwards. I'm not familiar with this type of degree. Just what initials does one put after their name after they earn this degree?
It's a very good question, Madam Chair, Representative Harker. Different states have adopted different titles for the various options. For instance, in the management ladder degree, the state of Nebraska calls it a applied baccalaureate in business administration and management. And for instance, in the inverse or upside down degree, in which someone first completes a technical or terminal degree and then turns around and gets general ed credits, it's typically comes under a bachelor's of general studies, a bachelor's of professional studies, or a bachelor of applied studies, depending on the institution.
Okay.
So ultimately, that will be a decision left up to the joint boards and the relevant institutions.
Thank you. The only degree name that you mentioned in there that sounds to me as one that is a BA or a BS, mm-hmm. was a Bachelor of General Studies, which was a degree that way back when I was in school, could be obtained by students at four-year schools mm-hmm. without declaring a major, basically. Mm-hmm. So is this the same type of Bachelor's of General Studies? I'm wondering about the mm-hmm. level of equivalency between this degree and a BA or a BS.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Harker, again, it would be up to the joint boards to determine the standards or qualifying criteria for the various degrees. The notion is not to so-called dumb down the requirements, but instead provide additional flexibility for students who have perhaps completed a terminal degree or have some general ed credits and yet want to go back to school in a more focused way. And so this would then provide them additional opportunities to get a four-year degree and maximize their earning potential over time.
Thank you. Representative Rublin?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. A statement and a question, I guess. Mm-hmm. I like Bachelor of Applied Arts, but because I think it has a difference. You know, as a math person in mm-hmm. college, I had another group of friends who were engineers. They were the application. We were the theory. And neither mixed. I mean, it was really sad, actually, because there were oftentimes I would like to have had a professor in a theoretical math class show me an application of this math, and that was something that they didn't necessarily want to do because it wasn't about applying, it was about mathematics. I would love that group of people who actually were in between those two degrees, who didn't want to be an engineer, but wanted to use what they were getting, and the math people had to get the theory behind it so that it worked. And for me, it's that idea of having people who are going to actually use this in day-to-day living situations, but needed to understand the underneath, you know, the real math principles behind it. And then they could talk to kids who could actually have an understanding about why they needed to know math, because they could do all these other kinds of things. For me as a math teacher in high school, to go out and try to find applications was always difficult because the people who were doing them didn't know they were doing math. And so I guess it's that kind of thing that I hope this mm-hmm. can lead to. Any suggestions or thoughts?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Roblin, that is exactly one of the student types that this program would address. You know, we're looking to help those who have gone in for a technical degree who could use the additional theory in order to advance their career, as well as to help those students who may have some general ed credits but then want to go back, who may be older students or dislocated workers who want to go back and get a terminal degree that they know will lead immediately to job opportunities.
Are there any further questions? Representative Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. First of all, Representative, you know, thanks for bringing this forward. I think anything that we can do to bring people, to allow people to who have felt themselves outside of the education mainstream and to be able to take their experience and combine it with the theoretical work that they can do to make themselves more, to move themselves up the career ladder, I think it's a great thing. Does the joint boards welcome this direction, would you say? I mean, what is the relationship, the background sort of relationship with the in this effort with what has gone on before? Could you say something about that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Dimbrough. I have spoken to the Chancellor, representative of the joint boards, as well as representatives of community colleges and OUS institutions. You will hear testimony on behalf of this bill from those folks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much for coming today, and we'll look forward to getting those amendments back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. I regret that I'm in committee as well, so I will be departing, but I appreciate your thoughtful consideration of this bill.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to be heard on House Bill 3093? Yes, please. Please begin your testimony by stating your name for the record.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, for the record, I am Bruce Schaefer, Director of Industry Affairs with the Oregon University System. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 3093. We're excited about the opportunity that it represents for both students and their future employers. We're working with the Community College and Workforce Development Department to identify a process that will be recommended to the joint boards, which represents both sectors. In that regard, we're also working with Representative Edwards and his staff on a small amendment that will clarify the charge to the joint boards. Again, we support the intent of the bill and the exciting opportunity that it will create for Oregonians. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Cam Preuss. I am the director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And it would be redundant for me to say exactly what my colleague, Bruce Schaefer, said. So I'm here to just add my voice of support to 3093. We are working with the sponsor, as he said, on a slight amendment. Right now, just before I left, I went to our website and pulled off a document. There are over 100 articulation agreements that currently exist between Oregon's 17 community colleges and the public and private four-year institutions in the state. And actually, there are articulation agreements that exist between community colleges as well. But this is just one of the four types that of applied baccalaureates that are listed in the proposed legislation. So Representative Edwards said, Oregon is only one of 11 states that doesn't have what we would call a structured applied baccalaureate, but we certainly have them in spirit in many places, and I think it would serve students well to move to perhaps a more structured environment. And I look forward to the study that is proposed in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. Two things. You know, the key to success to a program like this is ease of transfer, right, and ease of articulation. And that's, you know, I think one of the real benefits of the close and I think growing closer relationship between the community colleges and their OUS partners in this area. And so I'm wondering, do you see the future of this continuing to be more institution by institution or more, you know, kind of system-wide kinds of group articulation agreements? So that's one question. And the other has to do with the role of credit for prior learning, you know, work experience credit, how it would fit into this kind of program. It seems that there must be a place for it there, and I wonder if it's going to be addressed, again, in a systematic, structured way.
Chair Gelser and Representative Dimbro, safe answer, of course, this is too soon to say because the joint board's got a lot of study to do. I expect that they'll be torn between a perspective of, well, this is a way of adding structure to what we're already doing, and first tell us what all these 39 other states are doing so we can have an opinion. Mm-hmm. So we think the process will start by informing them of the best practices in other states. My personal opinion is that in some cases it will be piloting initially a pairwise arrangement, a particular community college or two with a particular university in order for Oregon to build some experience before it tries to roll out something statewide. And then over time, both the structure and the degrees themselves will become more statewide. As to credit for experience, one of the degree formats specifically has a method for doing that. What we need to understand is to what extent is that experience under the supervision of faculty, or is it arranged by an agreement with particular employers? And is it you sign up for a certain number of units of credit for your internship, or some other structure that meets both the student's needs and the future employer's needs?
Thank you very, very much. Representative Parker.
Go ahead. Oh, I can't override. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still getting at, is this a bachelor's degree? It's called a bachelor's degree. The third and fourth years are talked about. Is this a four-year degree?
Chair Gelser and Representative Harker, as it is proposed, yes, it is a four-year degree.
With in some cases, with credit for 2 years of study only, and 2 years that have been spent elsewhere.
Chair Gelser.
Gaining all sorts of practical, useful information and knowledge.
Representative Harker, that is one of the methods that is listed to be studied. I don't think I can venture to have a perspective on it yet. okay. Since it is not, it is actually not in the literature.
Lastly, slight change. At the end of it, the Board of Higher Ed, et cetera, are supposed to provide staff. This body is going to lovingly and respectfully gut their budgets. How are you going to provide those staff and support functionalities?
Chair Gelzer and Representative Harker, we have had this discussion with Representative Edwards as this will be the fourth study of some significance that has come before the department and answer for the university system. But we are past the place where we could absorb a study of this kind, so there will be a fiscal that will be attached to this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With a new degree program coming into being, if this happens, I think it would be really good to do some pre and post kinds of things about the need out there for these kinds of positions. Are there people who want to hire these people? Do they exist? And then, finally, I agree with Representative Denbro when he said, you know, one of the deals will be how easy it is to make this work, function within the deal. But more importantly will be how easy these people find work afterwards. And so knowing the, you know, what follows is from my perspective, really important. We haven't done a lot of that. We have traditional degrees that have been around forever. We've never really thought about changing them, so they exist because we've always done it that way. In this system, it would be nice to find out if we give people opportunity and there really is a need out there that they are filling that we haven't done before. So, because I think they will find that. There are places that have been looking for these kinds of degrees for a long time. Mm-hmm. We just haven't been producing them, so they've been figuring it out. And I always kid, for a couple of years, everybody I met was an electrical engineer by training. I had their degree, but they were doing everything. I mean, they were all over the place doing stuff. And I thought, they must really do something well in electrical engineering to get these people to have cross abilities in a lot of other fields. And so it would be interesting, because not everybody's going to get an electrical engineering degree. So I hope, if this keeps going, that we actually look to, you know, some of the needs assessment ahead of time and on those other kinds of things, because I think we can hopefully define the kinds of programs that are the most advantageous and might get support from outside of the institution when we talk about funding, if we are meeting a need that either business or society really feels that they need.
Excellent. Chair Gelzer and Representative Roblin, I certainly agree with the sentiment of your question. I think this is an opportunity to be more intentional. Oftentimes, the student's success seems to be 50% what we teach them, 50% their ability to adapt it to the real world. I think we can come closer to helping them adapt to the real world by designing applied programs like this.
Thank you
very much. Representative Comp,
just a comment, Chair Gelzer. Thank you. I serve on the Veterans Committee. And I served on the Veterans Committee in 2005, and we talked a lot about the support that our veterans, our returning veterans, deserve. And this is one of those ways that we can support people for the skills, their knowledge, and their experience that they've gained, particularly while serving our country. I mean, they're doing things that they never anticipated, but they have now actually started going into a profession and have earned a lot of knowledge. And so I think it's important to continue this investigation.
Thank you very much, and thank you both for coming today. Is there anyone else that was hoping to be heard on House Bill 3093? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3093 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3427. Kevin, do you want to give a brief introduction? And Representatives Springer and Thatcher, do you want to also go down to the hot spot?
Members of the Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 3427. This measure will be amending ORS 181-534 to allow a school district to request the Department of State Police conduct criminal records checks on an individual for non-criminal justice purposes. Allows the police to provide the Department of State Police to provide results of a criminal records check. It also defines districts that come within the purview of the legislation.
Great. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm sitting down here trying to envision Representative Roblum's Costco container of mints and what it looks like from here. But I'm here to talk about, both Representative Thatcher and I are here to talk about House Bill 3427.
Representative Springer, would you introduce yourself for the record because we've forgotten who you are?
I'd love to do this. I'd love to do that. I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative for House District 17. So we're here to talk about House Bill 3427, which simply allows school districts another tool to do their job. And what happens when an employee applies, and we tend to use the term teacher a lot, and we're talking about all employees, when they apply and they go through the records check process, they pay a $62 fee, the district does, to have this person checked. $10 of that fee goes to Oregon Department of Education to process it, and then it goes to the Oregon State Police to be processed. And with my background in as a deputy sheriff, I'm working the road and doing several of those checks, certainly not myself, but requesting those. It's a fairly simple process, and this is really fairly simple in that it allows, does not mandate, it allows school districts the choice to go directly to Oregon State Police and save that $10. So then we think, okay, in these multi-million dollar budgets, and I apologize for the districts that are smaller that don't have that many multi-millions, but in these large budgets with millions of dollars, does $10 really add up? Well, I remember sitting on, it's not going to happen this year for sure, but I remember sitting as a board member going through a consent agenda with 20 and 30 hires a couple, three times in the beginning of the year. And I'm not from that large of a district. So that money does add up. And quite frankly, I think right now when we can save a district any money, we need to be doing that. And again, I want to emphasize, this allows the option. They can continue with the process, the $62 if they want to. That would be their choice. This just allows another option for them. So. And then certainly I'll leave the rest to Representative Thatcher.
Well, thank you. I'll try to remember to identify myself for those of you who just don't know me. I'm Kim Thatcher, State Representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg. And thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today. And I'd like to just give you a couple numbers to think about. We're basically talking about 20,000 people in our public school system and perhaps 2,000 teachers who are in private schools that are not now licensed by TSPC and therefore not required by state law to undergo any background checks. And by one estimate, around half the school employees in Oregon are not required to be licensed by the state. We're talking about the teachers' aides, janitors, coaches, and other staff. And classroom volunteers would be another consideration. Right now, there are many school districts who do take the initiative to screen those workers through the Oregon Department of Education. This would be a $5 check. And it only includes information from Oregon records and does not involve fingerprints or any national access to any national database or the FBI. Should also mention that districts should be able to do their own background checks through OSP on teachers as well, since TSBC only runs a check on teachers when they renew their licenses. And there may have been something that happened between when they last renewed their license and the current day that they might want to check. Bottom line, we just want to give the school districts the flexibility to conduct more extensive background checks if they want to on their teaching or non-teaching staff. This is not a new idea. At the tail end of the 2007 session, Representatives Roland and Comp may remember Senate Bill 724. The House Education Committee adopted a nearly unanimous amendment, which did allow schools to go directly to OSP for background checks. However, it died in House rules. The legislation had other important components, such as requiring background checks for volunteers and requiring state and national checks for all school employees. In fact, the Oregon Law Commission reviewed these issues and found grounds for further work to be done. And while some of those issues remain critical issues, we felt it was important to look at those in a broader context, and today we're only asking to give the district the option to seek background checks from state police. Here are a couple examples to think about. The Beaverton School District only ran a $5 check on David Chapman, who was recently arrested for sexually abusing a teenage girl. He was a cheerleading coach. Oregon Department of Education check, that $5 check, showed he had a rap sheet, which included a misdemeanor assault, felony embezzlement, and a probation violation, but none rose to the level of the so-called unwaverable crime, like I think maybe you mentioned in your testimony. A longtime Beaverton school police officer and former Washington County sheriff's deputy was quoted in the paper saying that the laws in place aren't very strict for the people they allow in the classroom. Oregon could improve the situation by allowing institutions to see exactly what the charges are instead of just saying there are charges out there. House Bill 3427 would give Beaverton schools and all our districts the ability to see those charges by using the state police to do the screening. In Gresham, a teaching assistant working at an alternative school that was contracted to serve students from public schools nearby was arrested for raping a 15-year-old student. And when he was arrested, authorities uncovered an earlier conviction for rape. There was no screening process for this guy. And in St. Helens, a special ed teacher was convicted of inappropriately touching male students. This man was hired by the Rainier School District after TSPC gave him the green light. And even though the agency knew he had a history of molesting students, he was still working with these students. The school superintendent admitted that they should have done a more extensive background check of their own. And for those who say that school districts should not have access to criminal background information, I would say this. The Portland School District has run its own background checks through OSP for many years. Forest Grove has developed its own system for documenting references from past employers. And the Hillsborough School District subscribes to OJIN, the Oregon Judicial Information Network, so that they can see if an employee is currently facing some kind of legal action. We see House Bill 3427 as a fix, a simple fix to the law, which would only save money and give districts that extra bit of information they may feel is necessary to make a better informed decision. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there questions, representatives? Representative Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks for the presentation, both of you. Going back to the examples that you talked about, Representative Thatcher, so the one of, about the guy who had a number of issues that came forth, but the school hired him anyway. So what was it about the nature of the information request that was done that kept the school district from knowing about that and taking action? I mean, so how exactly would this fix that problem?
Chair Gelser, Representative Dimbrough. Well, that's really kind of a tongue twister sometimes you're sitting down here. As I understand, the current system, you have to go through Oregon Department of Education, and it's a $5 check. If they were able to do this, they would have had better information. It may not have changed, but they would have had the complete picture as to what this particular person had on their rap sheet.
Mm-hmm. So presumably, if I can follow up, Madam Chair, so they would have been told that there were issues about this gentleman, but nothing felony or something.
Chair Gelser, Representative Dimbrough, what? No problem with that one. It would just give them that information. Now, what they do with that, that's another thing. But it seems like it would raise some red flags.
That the current system doesn't catch, presumably.
The current system, thank you. The current system, as I understand it, does not give any specifics. It just says there's what they call unwaverables, that the district has no idea what they are, really. It's just not mentioned. I mean, it's just not detailed out to the school district what they are.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually believe this bill would end up costing school districts a lot more. I'm not against that. I'm just saying that if I were in a district and I had the right to get them, I would want to do it on all of my employees, which I probably wouldn't have done before. And now I'm going to pay $62 or $52, whichever the state police records costs, for everybody, because there would be a standard of caution that I would want to take if I had the opportunity personally. And that's because I would do that. I mean, every district wouldn't have to. So I save the 10, but I actually end up picking a whole lot more 52s up. So with regard to that. And the question is, how much care do I get? I mean, part of, I go back to health care costs. I don't like to equate the two. But all of a sudden, do I do this every year for every employee just to make sure that something hasn't come up in between that I didn't catch? Where does, that worries me about just costs for school districts. But I would tell you, I, for one, would want to be pretty cautious because kids are pretty important to me. So I'm not sure that I could use that. It will save money. It would save more than I have to do the 62 on all of them, but it's still, and we don't do it on all of them right now. Not that we shouldn't. I'm just saying that.
Unless you want to comment on it.
Go ahead.
Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin. It's my understanding that, well, at least for the pre-hires,
yes,
that the employee, the prospective employee, would be paying the $52.
That's true for pre-hires, but I'm saying I get the opportunity to do this. I can go back and check some other people. I'm a little, over time. Those, I think, well, I'd probably be negotiated, but it would be an issue about where they're paying. But, yes, sorry about that.
May I weigh in on that?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and Representative Roblin. What a great unintended consequence. Kids safer. Plain and simple. I think that's a great unintended consequence, and I think it's a great point that you surfaced.
Are there any further questions? Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there something implied or maybe even explicit in the term unwaiverables that indicates severity? I'm not familiar with this term.
I'll speak a little bit to that. I'm sorry. Chair Gelser and Representative Harker, and there's an ORS that outlines these, but the waivables are and I'm kind of looking at Representative Roblin here for head nods and shakes. There's a list of crimes that TSPC can waive and they cannot, and it's delineated. If it's a waivable, if it's an unwaivable, it's a deal breaker. And it's established by ORS. If it's not an unwaivable, then there's some discretion. That's a really good question for TSPC. I don't want to go too much deeper because I'm going to show what I don't know, and I certainly don't want to say anything that's less than accurate.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. So finding unwaivables on someone's small $10 search should be quite a flag, right? If I heard properly, one of the cases that you mentioned, there were unwaivables identified, but the person was hired anyway, right? And subsequent serious problems ensued.
Mm-hmm. That would be correct.
And from what I've just heard, think there should have been really good cause for looking more deeply into this person's background as soon as they established that they had unwaivables on there. But that was not done. Is that correct?
Chair Gelser, Representative Harker, it's my understanding that they didn't have a process in place to look deeper. That they are given this information from the Oregon Department of Education, that they had unwaivable offenses and were not specific. If they had been able to go directly to the OSP, they would have gotten the actual detail of what that was.
Okay, thanks. So this would give them a little bit more detailed info, but they would still act or not act on the information, right? We can't, and this bill doesn't attempt to address that at all.
Could you clarify for me? I've gotten lost in this conversation. If there was a conviction that the individual had that was on that unwaivable or unhireable list, because there's that list of prohibited convictions, how did the person get hired in the first place? I mean, isn't that an error that's beyond the and I'm not making an argument about the bill itself. I'm just kind of hung up on how this person got hired. If they had on their record convictions that by law preclude them from being hired in a public school building.
It's possible. Was this made from out of state? Is that why? Okay. It's my understanding that the Oregon Department of Education checks are based in the state of Oregon, and if there's any convictions outside of that, it would not surface necessarily.
Did I say that correctly?
Okay. Can my staff, she was very involved in that, I would like her to come up here. Just go over there. I don't want to speak.
Right. For the record, Dawn Phillips, Policy Director for Representative Thatcher, and a lot of you have been on the work groups. So we've been working on this, and this goes back to the Rainier case, William Boyce, or Boyce Williams, I can't remember. He did have a record from Alaska, and TSPC knew that he had problems in his past, gave him a license anyway. Rainier School District trusted TSPC's judgment and went ahead and hired him. Later, after he was found molesting these young boys as a coach and a special ed teacher in the Rainier School District, the superintendent then said, gosh, we should have done our own homework and not just trust TSPC. Maybe we could have had the ability to check with OSP on this guy's record. Maybe some red flags would have come up. And so that's what this bill might also address, is school districts who do want to do their own background checks directly to OSP, maybe in addition to whatever TSPC's done on their end in the licensing process. Does that answer that question?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Are there any further questions? Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair Felser. Was there any inquiry in if this was going to raise any additional costs for Oregon State Police? It's one thing when the department's calling one person to do a background check versus 197 school districts with different people ringing in and calling. And so did you happen to check on any possible impacts like that?
I don't think we've received a fiscal statement yet, but that is a reasonable consideration.
Okay.
But I also just got out of testifying on a bill to support volunteers in the state police that could maybe handle some of these items.
Okay.
So kind of interesting.
Thank you.
I think Representative Van Orman was in the queue.
Yes, thank you, Chair Gilser. I'm trying to sort out, you said that, I think you named about three different school districts that had already made a decision to go ahead and do it on their own. And so the question I have is, what precludes them from doing it now? Why do we have to have a new law when some are already able to do this?
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, if you look at the statute in the bill, I believe it's 326 is the operative statute here, and it only allows school districts to go through ODE right now. Portland found some loophole or some exemption to use state police. So they've been using it for quite a while and sending them a number of background checks, Representative Comp, so they do get quite a load from them. Hillsborough and Forest Grove are the ones that use OGIN and maybe their own LexisNexis type searches, not OSP. I believe Portland's the only one that currently uses OSP, and other districts would like to have that option.
Okay.
Jackson Rivlin.
I do want to go on the record that my biggest concern comes down to the cost over time. If people start thinking we have to do this for everybody all the time. Because in my history in 32 years in schools, that the reality is these events continue to be, and let's hope forever that they are rare, rarer than general public in a lot of places, and that most of our staffs are exceptionally good people who are doing an exceptionally difficult job under difficult conditions, whether that's teachers or custodians or my cooks or my bus drivers, and they are really amazingly good people. Having the tool to go if I have a concern or something is a really good thing. I would not want to get into the habit of doing it all the time and thinking that we don't trust people all the time, because so many of these people have devoted their entire lives to taking care and being vigilant on the kids. And so I worry that districts will start, you know, doing these, and all of a sudden they'll get back so many that are clear, which is what I expect all of them are, that they start not doing it just because they didn't find anything. And I like the tool, but I hope people will use it judiciously with regard to how to go about doing it. And the sad part is you can never really tell. I mean, we have neighbors and all other kinds of stuff that we would never have expected. But I and lost in this sometimes is the understanding of how pretty remarkably good all these people are that are working in these districts. Just a comment, I guess.
Thank you. Mr. My goodness, I'm better than that. Madam Chair, Representative Roldan, and I do believe that this bill would give the Oregon Department of Education the tools also to make rules on applicability of this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have two more witnesses on this bill, Andrea Meyer and Tricia Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I think this is a record session for us this year on fingerprint bills. And the reason I'm so puzzled is because in 2005, and I didn't bring my exhibit to show you all, but in 2005, Representative Cameron led a group that became increasingly large. Let me just say that. Not everyone fit in the room. And we produced a 60-page bill regarding the criminal history, fingerprint background checks. But this is something that actually ACLU has been involved in well before my time, and my predecessor, who's our executive director, David Fidanke, was kind enough a few years ago to give me some history around the fingerprint criminal background checks where we send off to the FBI. And I will take a moment, if I may, because actually it started in this area. It started with the schools and TSPC and Department of Education back in, I believe, the early 90s, wanting to do criminal history background checks on people who otherwise are not suspected of any criminal activity. I think it's worth remembering, just at least to frame the conversation, that for most of us, we don't deal with this unless and if we are ever arrested. And that is when the authority of government has to take our fingerprints and, in fact, retain our fingerprints in the criminal system. Otherwise, folks are generally, had historically not been required to turn over their fingerprints to government, to be employed, to travel, to do whatever in our society. But back in the early 90s, there was a movement afoot to do this for teachers. And since that time, every department, agency, bureau, board, everyone is doing it. It is becoming increasingly challenging. And the reason I understand, we have folks who have the authority over children, over vulnerable people, over a large group of folks, and we want the best and we want them to be safe. And I would add as an asterisk, we should always be careful, because while some people have been caught and convicted, there are people, as we know, doing bad things to everyone who have not yet been caught and convicted. So fingerprint criminal history has only a certain level of protection that it may provide. But for ACLU, we were significantly concerned about taking fingerprints of innocent people and sending them off to the FBI and getting a criminal history report back that might have a serious crime or might have a very minor crime. It might have a recent crime. It might have a crime from 30 years ago. And so there were a number of safeguards built into that almost 20 years ago that are critically important and continue to be maintained in the law. And one of those is who gets back the criminal history report. For the decision back then and was that TSPC would get it back for teachers who are licensed and Department of Education for non-licensed people. Criminal history has powerful information, we recognize, but it also has information that need not necessarily be distributed around a small community. And it could be a marijuana charge, it could be a shoplifting, it could be something embarrassing, it also could be something serious. But we also believe in people being reformed and reformation, and the fact that if they have moved forward and had a successful career and established that, that that's important to allow folks to continue to be employed who have move forward in their lives no matter the crime. Some of the other safeguards that were put in place and that you will see reflected in this law were critically important. We will not send these fingerprints to the FBI unless the FBI continues to assure us that they will not store
those fingerprints, and they are, in fact, are returned and destroyed. Now, unfortunately, fingerprints in the old days were the cards, and they were mailed off, and you might suppose that they would actually, when they were returned by the cards, the FBI would have no record of them. It's all digital now, so there are some who say to me, yeah, you think the government's really sending those back, but they are to send back and or destroy fingerprints of which someone has no criminal history. And then what happens in these bureaus and these agencies and these licensing and TSPC and DOE is they do a fitness test. That's another critical piece that was very important in putting this whole puzzle together. And I will get to TSPC and DOE in a minute because they are special. But in general, there is a fitness evaluation that is done by the agency, the head of the department, where they look at the criminal history, they look at how long ago it was, but they also look at some other things. So simply having a crime on your record should not mean we're done with you, we're not going to hire you, you're not going to get licensed, you're not going to work for this department. Rather, they need to look at the whole context. What was the crime? How long ago? What is their employment history? What are their letters of recommendation? A whole host of things, so that we just don't set up a system where if you've had any kind of crime in the past, you cannot be employed, you cannot be licensed, you cannot do anything. It all connected with the government of state of Oregon versus people who have a clean system. Because, again, someone who had a drug charge 30 years ago might be absolutely fit to hold many jobs today. So that was an important piece. However, there is an exception, and that exception actually currently exists for TSPC and Department of Education. And there are listed under, and you'll see it referenced it's ORS 342-143 in the bill. You don't see them. But that is the list of significant numbers of crimes to which if a person has been convicted in the state of Oregon or anywhere in this country and applies for a license or a certain position with the Department of Education, they are done. They do not get the job. It does not matter the circumstances, the length of time, how much they have done, if it was 20 or 30 years ago. They are significant crimes set under ORS Chapter 163 that are probably most of the sex abuse, violent felony crimes, person crimes, and on and on. So that is unique. And we've already made it a policy in the state of Oregon that we will not allow anyone to be licensed. And that is actually a significant concern to the ACLU because we do think that each person should be assessed independently and one-on-one, and that doesn't happen here. So what this law tends, we read it, to do would, instead of the safeguards that we think are critical that were put into place 18 years ago, which says if you're a TSPC licensed, the TSPC does this evaluation. They look at it, they evaluate, they license. We do not give it to the local school district. We try to have some uniform policies and practices in terms of the evaluation, the fitness test. We don't want this information released out in a small community. We don't want someone's criminal history discussed and talked, and some of the safeguards are simply to restrict who can see it. So that's an important piece that was put in place many years ago, and we would urge this committee, with all due respect, to not move forward to House Bill 3427. This is really part of a larger issue, and having done about 10 bills this session already, I see another interim work group developing, nonetheless, on the whole host of areas of fingerprint criminal history background checks. And I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I served on a work group last interim on this issue. And the product, one of the products, in fact, the product of that work group on criminal background checks is in your committee right now. It's Senate Bill 46. And we were hoping that that would be the bill that this committee considers movement into the statutes. I've been involved in the fingerprint issue since 1991 when it was first proposed in this body. And Ms. Meyer is correct. School district employees were the first target of this because of, obviously, of their access to children. OSEA, initially, our members were very opposed and very offended at the idea that they should have to undergo criminal background checks to continue to do the jobs for kids that they'd been doing for 15 or 20 years. But they have come to support this very strongly. They now believe that it is indeed a very important gatekeeper mechanism in its current form, because they have come to trust that the information that is gleaned is used appropriately and is only shared where it needs to be. And we have crafted, I believe, a system with our fingerprint printing and criminal background checks in the 197 school districts that works. It works for employees, it works for prospective employees, and I believe it works for employers and the public. House Bill 3427, I think, will complicate unnecessarily a process that does what it is intended, which is to screen out anyone who has ever been convicted of that huge list of crimes that Ms. Meyer was talking about. And it is a very long list. I'm sorry I didn't think to bring it with me. And it runs a very wide gamut of crimes, not all felonies, some misdemeanors. And it was very well and carefully thought out and added to and amended over time. And this issue, as if you're hearing me say, this issue has been very carefully crafted to balance the rights of individuals with the needs of the public to protect our children. That's exactly what I'm saying. Senate Bill 46, we believe, provides some enhancements by including contractor employees and by changing the definition of those who will be fingerprinted in schools from its current language, which says anyone who has unsupervised access to students, to anyone who works for a school district. So nobody has to think about whether or not that employee will ever have access. We support Senate Bill 46. We think everyone who works with children in our schools should be fingerprinted before they get there. But we do not support school districts in themselves going after that information and receiving it back from the FBI and from the state police, because that means that there is a lot of information that may not be relevant that will then be in the hands of secretaries and administrators and will be the subject of discussion where it should not be. So we would ask you to not move forward House Bill 3427, but rather to schedule and move Senate Bill 46. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Lipson and Maurer.
Madam Chair, Andrea, I have a concern about Portland Public Schools. Why is Portland Public School System treated differently than what the ORS permits?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, I'm not aware that Portland or any other school district is treated differently or has different access or authority under the state law. It is uniform. And I'm happy to, you know, have more information provided and clarification, but this is the first I've ever heard of that, and I can't.
Okay. That is concerning that a different standard would be applied.
Now, Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, do know that I think any of us can actually run a names check through Oregon State Police on any of each other for $15. So there are different kinds of, when we talk about background checks, we need to be aware it might be there might be a name check in the state, and that anyone can do. So the school district could be doing that. I can do it on you. I promise not to, and you can do it on me. Go ahead. But it's different than the authority. The Oregon State Police has to have statutory authority, and the FBI has to have statutory authority for it to receive criminal fingerprints to run an FBI fingerprint background check. So I suspect that's where the confusion might lie.
Right. And, Madam Chair, follow up. That the issues are no different in small towns as they are in large towns, and I don't want to be culturally insensitive to small-town America, even though my community is on that cusp of, because we're 31,000 for some reason. And then last but not least, I will have my ACLU application as soon as I complete my fingerprint cards.
Oh, Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, for you, we will make an exception, and you will not need to submit that to become a member for only $20 to the ACLU.
Okay.
Representative Van Orman.
I'm going to get you a membership as a gift. I keep doing this every committee.
Would that be permissible, Chair Roblin?
What's that?
It's less
an
than
ACLU
$50.
Gift.
Or your committee can
get
it.
It's under $50.
And if a book comes along with it, you get the book too.
You will get a card.
Oh, but we do not disclose our membership, and so I will not disclose other than mine.
And I've been a bit of
well, I thank you, Madam Chair. I've been on, this is my, I think, my second exposure to this criminal history check. And I guess this is probably for Andrea. I suddenly realized that when I first started teaching, I was fingerprinted in California. And then in the 90s, Head Start became one of the schools that had to do that. So I've had a criminal history check. So then I went to the school district to be a volunteer. And then I was supposed to undergo another check. And I had personally decided that if I had to go through another check, I wasn't going to be a volunteer. It was that plain and simple. So the question I have is that I am concerned that we have multiple checks. And is there any way that we can possibly get this somehow centralized or streamlined so that people aren't going through these multiple checks?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, I think so, yes. And the approach I would suggest this legislature consider, although it might be by agency, is what I saw in the DHS administrative rules. What we required 4 years ago in the House bill that I, 2157, I believe the big bill was, one of the things, again, the safeguards is, you, if it's your criminal history, you will get a copy of your report. Because sometimes there are errors and you have the right to get a copy of the report so you can challenge them. What I saw, and I don't know the scope with DHS, is that if a person holds on to their criminal history report, it might be good up for 2 years, or we could make it longer. I mean, I think we have flexibility in how long it is valid. And you could do a names check with Oregon State Police. That's much cheaper. If the person has stayed within the state of Oregon, they've had residence or they've worked, I think there's little to suspect they went afar, were arrested for a serious crime and somehow got back into the state of Oregon, served their time in that period. So there are ways. I would be concerned about, and am concerned about, sort of databases or other ways to have people enter into a system that says they've had one. But I think if the individual has their criminal history report and can show that to whoever is the authorizing entity, so TSDC or Department of Education, that would start saving some money, reduce the multiple costs, especially in other career positions where people are more mobile in their work and they need it. So that's where I'd like to see us go as a way to provide it without the sending it back out to the FBI again.
Are there any last questions for this panel? Representative Thatcher.
I don't know if it's a question, but you're talking about personnel records, basically, when you say there would be a criminal background check that maybe becomes the subject of or in the possession of secretaries and whatnot, it might become an inappropriate conversation. Wouldn't that hold true for any personnel records?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, not necessarily. This would be much broader because this is anyone who is offered a position with the school district must go through a criminal background check. If you don't, for some reason, then become an employee of that school district, that information would still be there with the district. So it wouldn't be in a personnel file. There wouldn't be any protections of that information based on personnel law or employment law.
Okay, and one more.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that there is a representative of the Department of Education way back in the corner hiding. He is not the expert in the department on how the Department of Education handles fingerprinting, but I think he could provide some clarity to some of these questions if you wanted to call him up.
Well, and I think in the interest of time and kindness, we do have two other hearings, so perhaps we can, if we get questions to Morgan, then we could get them back and write into the whole committee. Would that be okay? And did you have a follow-up?
I was going to talk about the existing fingerprint policy, so that one maybe would be a good question to have distributed to the committee after it's answered.
Great. So it sounds like we're looking for the current fingerprinting policy. Thank you. All right. Any further questions for these two?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Was there anyone else that was waiting to be heard on House Bill 3427? Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3427, opening a public hearing on House Bill 3116. Kevin, can you give us a brief overview?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3116 is a matter that deals with bonded indebtedness, and it provides that if bonded indebtedness for the benefit of a community college district, all district voters residing within the boundaries of the district are entitled to vote on the election. It provides that if bonded indebtedness is for the benefit of a specific service area, only the community college district area voters residing within the boundaries of the affected areas are entitled to vote on the action. It also does provide for an ad valorem tax as necessary.
Thank you. And I would call up Dean Wendell and Karen Smith, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Smith, and I'm here representing the Oregon Community College Association. We introduced this bill on behalf of two of our expansion districts, Rogue Community College and Bloom Mountain Community College, to address a unique provision in the statute that Dean will talk about a little bit further. But basically, the statute with regard to these two expansion districts requires them to take bond questions out to both of their service areas. They're not permitted to have a one district vote like all of the other community college districts. And so the purpose of this bill is to give them the option of either taking it to their service areas or taking it out to the district as a whole for a vote. We are also working on an amendment. We have a few of our community college districts who would like to have the option. Currently, they can only take it out to their entire district. They would like to have the option of taking it out to individual service areas. And so we're currently working on an amendment to do that for them. But I'd like to turn it over now to Dean Wendell, board member of Rogue Community College, who can give you some history and background on why his board would like this change.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dean Wendell. I'm a longtime board member of Rogue Community College. I'm also a commissioner of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Rogue Community College, about 12 years ago, the governor, Kassaver, and the administration wanted to have community college services in all areas of the state, and some places were didn't have community college services given to them. Medford, Jackson County was one of them. And they asked Rogue Community College Board to annex Jackson County into the district. I was on the board at that time. Rogue Community College started in Josephine County, was paid for under an old system where taxpayers, property taxes paid for things rather than come to the state. And the school was up and built and very well operating, debt-free. And for us to annex another county bigger than we are, we had some concerns about that. And in that area of having maybe bond levies to build into Jackson County, flow over to Josephine County to pay for it. And also the board would change from 7 members from Josephine County to 2 from Josephine County, 5 from Jackson County. Over the years, these concerns have really gone away as we've matured into a full service area for Southern Oregon. A lot of things in Southern Oregon are joint together, both counties. The economic development agencies were one in Joseph County, one in Jackson County. Now it's one. The ESDs was Jackson County ESD, now it's a Southern ESD. And our concerns about the having this separate and only by service areas is kind of a handcuff into and rather into a opportunity to be a safeguard. And we support this issue to have it the option to either go by the service area, which might be in a smaller area within the county, or by the whole district, just to give us opportunity to address some chances to do whatever is needed for the students in the area. And our board unanimously supports this change, as I was also contacted by John Turner, president of Blue Mountain Community College, that they support this change too. And we ask your support in recommending this change to the, it's more of a housekeeping thing than it is a really a major change in law. So
thank you very much. I represent Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm still trying to wrap my brain around this, and I'm thinking of one of my, I represent two community colleges, or have two that have campuses out off of the main campus mm-hmm. in my district. And so when you're talking about a service area, so I'm trying to think, Limbitton Community College has a satellite and Sweet Home.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm understanding correctly, you want the ability to tax just the people that are in that area for that campus. Is that portion correct?
Representative Gessler, Chair Gessler, Representative Springer, that's the way it is now.
Okay.
And that does work now. And we have, for instance, in the town of Kirby, which is near Cave Junction, we're building a learning center down there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had funds from another source. We didn't need to do a Bonney level. But if they wanted to put one in Kirby or in a Butte Falls or in an area, they could have their own separate service area. Service area in this case was meant service area Joseph County, service area Jackson County was the two service areas, but it can be, could be down to a smaller area. But right now we cannot do a district-wide bond indebtedness levy at this time. We're asking to be able to do it district-wide. Recently, through the some state funds for bond funds or capital construction funds, we were able to build a very nice higher education center in Medford, with jointly with SOU and RCC, and it's something like that that might be take more than just one service area to do, to make things better for the students. And that's a goal of all of us, is to make it more accessible and affordable for the students in our area.
Follow up, please. Hello. So are service areas already established? And let me outline that question, maybe give you a little background there. I'm just trying to figure out who it is you decide if you want to grow a particular service area, how it is you define that service area, because it's not necessarily always county, it's not necessarily always the K-12 school district, and it's not necessarily always a town, especially my rural district.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Springer, each college course is its own separate system, and we're not a system of community college. Because each one is different. So I really don't know what Lynn Bent might have in their service areas. But as I understand it, and the way we came in saying is that the service area primarily was Josephine County and Jackson County in our particular situation, and in Blue Mountain, is there, how they determine it. But there could be sub-service areas, like a rural area would like to have something done. The voters in that area would think they'd want to have something added to the area that's not presently there. Like Kirby, which is a very rural town in near Cave Junction in Illinois Valley, and that could have been a service area, but it wasn't necessary to do that. We didn't have to do that in this
Thank
case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Norman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. But the reality is, though, it's still the service areas within the defined district as approved by the voters. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Just that's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dimbro.
But thanks, Madam Chair. So Rogue is a particularly, it's a special kind of situation,
yes,
because of the way that there was this merger essentially that happened. Most districts will have kind of branch campuses, but each branch campus is not a different service area. So we're really talking about a very exceptional kind of situation,
yes,
here, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that Lynn Benton could set up sort of mini districts within itself. And
thank you very much. Any final questions? Thank you both very much. Was there anyone else here wishing to be heard on this bill? No, thank you very much. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3116 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2949. Kevin.
Members of the committee, Chairman Gelser, Chair Gelser, I'm having a problem today. Let's try that again. Before you is House Bill 2949. This is a measure that allows for-profit institutions of higher education to allow students to qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant to use those resources at for-profit higher education. This also would apply to opportunity grants awarded during the 2011 school year, academic year, and the measure itself would take effect on July 1st, 2010.
Thank you. And so we would call it representative comp.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and colleagues. For the record, my name is Betty Comp, and I serve House District 22, which is North Salem, Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and all the sunny parts of I-5 today. I am pleased today to speak in support of House Bill 2949, which would extend eligibility to opportunity grants to students attending private degree-granting career colleges with campuses in Oregon. It is also my pleasure to introduce three students that are attending those career colleges to explain why this is so important. I support House Bill 2949 because I believe opportunity grants are about opportunities for students, not entitlements to institutions. Need-based student aid should go to students based on their eligibility, not the business model of the institution they attend. Opportunity grants should support students' choices to pursue education and prepare for a career. Students who earn a degree, whether in math or culinary arts, teaching, or industrial design, improve their chances to earn more over their lifetime, make greater contributions to society and the economy, and pay more taxes. The choice of career colleges is recognized under federal law, qualifying students for Pell Grants and other federal aid. Career colleges exist because they meet a need. Some 10,000 students, more than 90% of whom are Oregonians, choose degree-granting career colleges because of their small class sizes, hands-on instruction, and flexible schedules. At this time, time is passing. I would love to introduce three students, and they'll come forward, and I wish that you'd open your arms to Angie Cassania, Scott Cook, and Natasha Phillips.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Welcome, and thank you for your patience. I know it's been a long hearing waiting for your slot.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angie Kasonga. I am a student in the accounting program at Everest College, which is a school that's been around since the 1950s. I've lived in Oregon my whole life. I am the oldest of 10 children, and I grew up in a very low-income family, so you can imagine that saving for college was definitely not an option. I attended and graduated from Ridgeport High School. In high school, I studied accounting for 2 years, and I really liked it, but since no one in my family had gone to school, and I didn't know about financial aid, I didn't think that going to college was an option for me. I had my daughter shortly after graduating, and I started working as a caregiver and eventually as a resident manager in adult care homes. When my last job ended, I decided that I needed to go back to school. But my credit wasn't good, and I wasn't sure that I could get financial aid. I had a friend that graduated from Everest College, and he told me how great the accounting program was, and so I decided to check it out. And they made it so easy for me to get enrolled. And I liked the fact that they have small classes and that they've made it fit into my schedule. And so I'm halfway through my accounting program right now, and I have 4.0 GPA. And I'll be graduating in April 2010 with my associates. After graduation, I plan on continuing my education, working as an accountant or bookkeeper, and eventually one day opening one or more adult care homes in the Portland metro area. Now, what I don't understand is why the Oregon Opportunity Grant is not available to me. It is my understanding that the grant is available to help all low-income Oregonians achieve their educational goals so that they can get better jobs and be less of a financial burden on society. That is exactly what I'm trying to do. So why should my choice of school play a part in deciding if I qualify for the grant, which would be so helpful in this transitional stage of my life? It shouldn't matter. It should be open to all Oregonians, regardless of which school they choose. So I'm asking you to please amend the Oregon Opportunity Grant to include students attending private colleges. Please give all Oregonians a chance to succeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and community members. My name is Scott Cook. I live in Canby, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on such an important issue. I have lived in Oregon for 30 years, and I graduated from Philomath High School in 1988. I have attempted higher education twice in my life, and due to the conflicts...
Do you want to pull the mic over a little closer so that everyone can hear you? Thanks.
Unfortunately, due to conflicts in my learning style and the theory-based programs at other schools, I was unable to succeed, so I went to work. I am a visual and a kinesthetic learner, so the theory-based teaching style made it difficult, so it led me eventually to drop out. Other than various jobs I've had, I drove truck for 8 years. Driving is an honest living, but there's no future in it. It's more of a job than a career. I needed something different, and I wanted to improve my life, and education is the best way to do so. I did some research and found that ITT had a good reputation, and they had a hands-on curriculum, and that could solve my problems with my past history. I started attending ITT in 2006. It was the best thing I ever done. I have earned my associate degree in computer electronic engineering. I graduated in March of 2008 with highest honors, and I was class speaker. I was awarded a magna cum laude and with for a GPA of 3.86 and nominated to the Alpha Beta Kappa Honor Society. I have chosen to continue school, and I am 1 year away from my bachelor's degree in industrial automation engineering technology. I found that the instructors at ITT were great. They go out of the way to make sure you understand the material, and they have knowledge and experience from working in your fields of study. And with the small classes, they also have time to work with one-on-one with the students to make sure you understand. The hands-on training ties together the theory and the practical experience of the skills that are being taught, and that is what made it possible for me to succeed as well as I did. The career services department that ITT provides a long, lifelong placement assistance for graduates. They go out of the way to make sure the students are prepared with skills in resume writing, proper interviewing techniques, and salary negotiation, with a strong emphasis on soft skills. Career Services also develops relationships with local companies to ensure the curriculum and the students have the right current skills to succeed. I found my current job through ITT Career Services. I work at RTEC Aircraft Supplies in Aurora, Oregon. I am currently a quality assurance lead and the calibration preventive maintenance technician. I believe it's a very important position because we work on, we build emergency locator transmitters for airplanes. So our products that are used in the search and rescue field. I'm a hardworking citizen, and I have increased my income over 30% in the first year since I have been in the industry. Since I have been at ITT, I'm eligible for the Pell Grant and through federal loans. That's how I've paid for my education, and I believe, in my opinion, it is unfair that not every student in the state of Oregon has the same opportunity that I have to improve their life, and with the addition of the Oregon Grant would help every one of us in the state to improve one's life. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Natasha Phillips. I'm from Portland. I'm 30 years old. I am a single mother of three. I've had the luxury of being a stay-at-home mom. After raising kids for 10 years, I was divorced and left to raise my three kids on my own. I decided to pursue my career in culinary arts. I chose Western Culinary Institute because they offered a Le Cordon Bleu program. While on tour of the school, I noticed that the classrooms were actual kitchens, and I knew that I would get an education that applies classroom theory with work settings. After 6 months in the culinary program, I chose to switch my program over to hospitality and management. I decided to stay at Western Culinary Institute and further my education there due to the smaller class sizes that provided me more in-depth curriculum. It gave me a chance to excel at a much faster pace rather than getting lost in a classroom with 60 other students. I feel that the smaller class ratio has benefited my progress tremendously. Traditional colleges didn't appeal to me because of all the prerequisites that you had to take before even touching any topic that related to my degree. I have attended community colleges in the past and did not complete them due to the amount of book work compared to the hands-on education that works for me. Had I chose a traditional college, I would have been in school for 4 years as compared to 14 months. Being a single mom of three, I didn't have 4 years to put towards my education. I needed to get through college at a fairly rapid pace to be able to provide for my family. I don't feel that because I chose to go to a college that focuses on one program and not a lot of courses, that I shouldn't qualify for an opportunity grant. Even though this House Bill 2949 will not benefit me while I am in college, it would have been very helpful would I have given the opportunity to pay my school loans off sooner, and I would have taken on less debt. I would be in a better position to start college funds for my children that much earlier in their lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Thatcher.
Actually, thank you. And I'm not sure if this is a question you can answer. And believe me, I think you're onto something when you say, why should me going to, you know, a targeted education, me receiving a targeted education preclude me from help from, you know, paying this? So when I say this, I'm wondering, I heard Scott say maybe you say that you got help from the Pell Grant to pay for your education. I'm just wondering if there's some flexibility in these private for-profit schools that doesn't exist in the public realm as far as financing and that. Were you able to do that, or was it all through loans, federal loans, or Pell Grants?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I was only able to get the Pell Grant. All the rest is through federal loans.
In other words, it wasn't through any financing cooperation from the schools?
No.
Okay.
Are there more questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. You all have, your stories are incredible, and you've done very well today.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to invite Vicki Parker. Welcome, Ms. Parker.
Thank you. Madam Chair, everybody else. Good afternoon. My name is Vicki Parker, and I am a student at DeVry University in Portland. Thank you very much for the opportunity to let me speak today. Chairwoman Geisler, members of the committee, I am here today in support of House Bill 2949. This bill is critically important to Oregon students like me who presently are ineligible to receive Oregon Opportunity Grants simply because of the institution we chose to attend. For the last 4 years, I have worked at Franz Family Bakery in Portland. While I have enjoyed my time at the bakery, it has never been fulfilling work. As a single mother, my main concern has always been providing for my children. I felt that a stable income took priority over a rewarding career, considering my two children that depend on me. A few years ago, I developed an interest in the rights of the elderly. Several of my friends began taking care of their aging parents, and as a friend, I listened to their concerns. As I listened to the stories of neglect and their parents were encountering in nursing homes, I became equally frustrated and upset. These stories really weighed on my heart, and soon my mission became clear. I want to advocate on behalf of the elderly in order to prevent abuse and neglect in nursing homes and other forms of managed care. In 2007, after much discussion and soul searching, I decided to return to school. I took the initiative to research several institutions and compare graduation rates, employment statistics, program availability, and locations. This information, combined with the flexibility of course offerings, is what attracted me to DeVry. The school is a well-known, high-quality institution in my area that allows me to take courses on campus as well as online, a feature that really helps me manage my schedule. The staff is extremely supportive and encourages me to dream big. Because of their encouragement and the support of my children, I now am pursuing my bachelor's degree in business administration with emphasis on healthcare. Financial support is a huge concern for most of us contemplating higher education. As someone who has numerous other financial obligations, opportunity grant funds would have helped me significantly. I feel that as a lifelong Oregonian with financial need, I should be able to receive assistance to further my education at the school of my choice. DeVry is the school that works best for me. Attending a state university wasn't the right fit for me at this point in my life. DeVry continues to provide me the knowledge, skills, abilities to change my career to a greater extent in my life. I can say without hesitation that I am happy with my educational experience, but would have benefited greatly from an opportunity grant. I implore you to consider allowing all Oregonian students to be eligible for this funding. I am happy to say my degree will be completed in 12 months. My children are extremely proud of their mother. Watching me these past 2 years has shown them that they too can achieve their goals through hard work and dedication. My 12-year-old daughter has recently told me that I'm a good influence on both her and my 15-year-old son. Both children have demonstrated this through steadily improving grades. I now feel better that our future, with renewed hope and great expectations for all of us. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Are there questions? Thank you very much, and congratulations to all of you on your degrees. Next, Gina Workstrom, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gina Wickstrom, Executive Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation, here today in support of House Bill 2949 with the -1 amendment. Let me add just a few points to the comments that have been made by Representative Comp and by our wonderful students. House Bill 2949 would expand the eligibility for opportunity grants to students that are attending accredited degree-granting professional and technical institutions that come under the regulation of the Office of the Office of Degree Authorization for those that have campuses in Oregon. This eligibility would not begin until the 2010-13 biennium. Career colleges add valuable educational capacity in Oregon, especially in more costly, capital-intensive programs, and we do so at no cost to the taxpayers of Oregon. Donors invest all kinds of expensive and resources and sophisticated lab equipment for up-to-date and current programs and computer applications. Let me point out that these colleges pay taxes both to the state and to the federal government. The student bodies consist primarily of Oregonians, either 90 to 95% on a given year. And they choose to attend those colleges for the reasons that you heard from our students today, a career-focused education, flexible work-study opportunities, and also the long-standing history of assisting our students with obtaining employment in a good-paying job. When we do attract students from out of state, they come, they often stick around, and they train in fields such as creative arts, food preparation, food art as I call it when I visit some of these schools, electronic design, and they provide an incredible service to the key industry clusters in Oregon, providing us a great service for quality employees.
The Oregon Career Colleges, covered by House Bill 2949, confer associate and bachelor degrees. They are accredited just like the state's public and other post-secondary institutions. Their accrediting agencies make sure they are accountable for the students that graduate from their colleges. They make sure that the students that are graduating are seeking employment and obtaining employment in field-related jobs. And they require that those institutions go on and continue to track those students to ensure that the education that they have received is allowing them to move up the career ladder. I think we need to point out again that these schools are highly regulated, not only by their accrediting agencies, by the Department of Education, as in the U.S. kind, but also by the Office of Degree Authorization. None of that is an easy task. Eligible career college students do qualify for federal Pell Grants, and we hope that you all will consider and agree that it is very, it's very good, it's very fair that all Oregonians are eligible for the Opportunity Grant Program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Dimbro.
Thanks, Senator Chair. Just clarification, Gina. This is geared towards students who are degree-seeking, right? And so maybe you could talk about that a little bit, how the difference between a degree and a certificate, if you could just explain that.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, of course. The degree-granting institutions have a layer of oversight and accreditation standards that we believe that are more parallel with those other institutions that are currently approved to participate in the Opportunity Grant program and can provide you, the policymakers, the lawmakers, the oversight assurances that those institutions are doing what they need to do and that the students are on the right career path for them, enabling them to move on up that education ladder of degree attainment.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm not sure how to formulate the question here, but I'm wondering if there's been any concern or thought about, if we receive any state funds, are we going to have perhaps potentially some additional criteria placed upon us, especially when it comes to employing our teachers? Or I'm just wondering if that has been a concern or a thought that's crossed your mind.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, absolutely. The criteria for participation in federal and state level financial aid is covered under the processes that institutions currently undergo to participate in those programs. The oversight that's required by the Department or the Office of Degree Authorization and the U.S. Department of Education, it would be an element of training and an element of certain reporting to the state of Oregon for participation in those programs. It's certainly an element of participation and additional work that our schools would welcome and that would benefit our students greatly. So, of course, anytime you add a new program, there's another element of training, another element of reporting. Great.
Further questions? Representative Van Orman.
Oh, thank you, Chair Gelser. So the grant actually goes to the school, or the grant actually goes to the student?
Are you
the
now
opportunity
chair.
Grant?
It's my understanding that the opportunity grant is for the student. And okay. We, of course, if other institutions have it deposited into their treasury, we would certainly welcome the opportunity to explore with whomever we need to explore with how that money should be handed to the student or taken care of on behalf of the student. But we believe firmly it's the student's money.
Thank you.
And could you briefly tell us what the Dash 1 Amendment does?
Dash 1 Amendment makes it clear that it's different from what you all saw in the original bill. And the Dash 1 Amendment makes it clear of when the effective date would be. Back on page, and I'm going to turn to Gary Conkling for a clarification on where the pages that makes the decisive changes. Page 4?
Line 10.
It's the final line.
Thanks, that's the one.
It's the
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Conkling, and I represent the Northwest Federation of Career Colleges. We had the Dash 1 amendment drawn because there were a couple of questions that were less clear than the original draft that came out. One was when the bill became effective and in what biennium eligibility would begin for career college students. And it was our effort to try to make the eligibility not occur until the 2011-2013 biennium. So not the immediately ahead biennium, but the following. And we did that advisedly so that the discussion of this bill could be on its policy merits, not on the question of thinning the soup for the opportunity grant for students who are currently eligible. The second significant change is on page 1 of the amendment, to just make it very clear what institutions we're referring to. And so we ask counsel to be a little more precise, and particularly, and I think you can see the language which Ms. Wickstrom in her testimony referenced, but notice that it also referenced a physical campus. And we think that that is something that's important as you contemplate this eligibility, that we're talking about institutions that are physically located here.
Thank you very much. Any final questions, Representative Huffman?
I'll try to get this out. I think I regained composure. Just a comment, Madam Chair. As Vice Chair of the Workforce Committee, Workforce Development, also a member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, allowing opportunities for particularly adult students in Oregon to be able to skill up has been a very important goal of ours.
I'd like to hear.
And I think the private institutions represent, as we heard from the testimony today, a key part of that puzzle for getting people's incomes up, in a lot of cases getting them off of assistance and getting them skilled up in the industries that the state needs. And so I just wanted to convey that I think this is an important piece of that puzzle.
We do private school.
Thank you very much. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Huffman basically said what I was leaning towards, and the fact that we have a vision in Oregon to have 20% of our students all to graduate from high school, another 40% to get their associate's degree, another 40% to get their bachelor's degree. This is another part of that continuum so that everybody can be as successful as they have their potential. And so it's just another one of those things that we ought to give careful consideration, please.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, Representative Roland.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know if people from the Department of Degree Office of Degree Authorization are going to be here to talk about this? I mean, I think there's a lot of people on this committee who are new to education who haven't heard from them, and I think it would be nice to know the criteria under which they credit these schools, because it's a pretty rigorous set of standards that are applied. And I don't know if you've talked to them about this bill as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, yes, we have talked with the Office of Degree Authorization about the criteria for eligibility should it come to pass. And I will say this, that it is known across the nation that in order to obtain degree authorization in Oregon is one of the toughest initial and ongoing issues that you can do. So I feel very comfortable that an institution that has obtained authority to confer degrees in Oregon is being looked at very closely, and folks can be assured that those degrees are something that are very, very valid and being looked at.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Colleagues, remember tomorrow evening, Tuesday night, 5:30 p.m., hearing room 50. I do expect we will have a large crowd, so bring some carrots and expect to be together for a few hours, maybe some chocolate.
And with that, the House Committee on Education is adjourned.